Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming this evening. Welcome to this evening's Writers at Warwick, that's been arranged in conjunction with the Students' Union's One World Week. And thank you all for the contributions that you've made to this wonderful festival. It's a real pleasure for me to welcome Preeti Nair to Warwick this evening. Preeti Nair was born in Kerala in South India in 1971. She moved to England when she was 2 years old, living in East London and then Wembley, where now she lives. After studying law and economics at Cardiff University, she moved to Spain, where she worked at the European Commission for 4 years. She then returned to Britain to study for a master's in international relations here at Warwick. So it's wonderful to welcome you back to Warwick to lead as part of this student festival. Whilst working as a management consultant in London, Preeti started the manuscript for her first novel, Gypsy Masala, on the tube whilst travelling to and from work. After finding it hard to get a publisher, Preeti took the plunge and published the novel herself in the year 2000 to great success, quickly going to number one in Books etc. in Finchley and other bookshops around the UK. Reviews have said that this beautifully written book will transport you to another world and a gem of a book which you will read in one sitting. Following the success of Gypsy Masala, publishers started a bidding war for the rights to her next book, 100 Shades of White, described as a magical novel about mothers and daughters and the mystical healing power of food, from which she'll be reading this evening. Lastly, Preeti Nair was recently honoured at the Asian Women of Achievement Awards, winning the Young Achiever Award. So could you all join with me in welcoming one of our newest talents here this evening?
Thank you. Feels kind of strange coming back, because it's been about 8 years since I've been back, and I was driving around the car park thinking, lots changed. I'm just going to begin by telling you my story about how I got into publishing and how I became a writer, a published writer. And then I'm going to do a bit of a reading from the new book, 100 Shades of White. I think I always knew I wanted to be a writer. Ever since I was about 5 or 6, that's all I just spent my time doing. But my parents had other plans for me, my dad in particular, who bought me an entire volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica, aged 5, and he was preparing me in a career for law. So all he would do the whole time, instead of reading children's books, was to read me The Principle of Law. So I knew at a young age the direction he wanted me to head in. And then I did, to cut an incredibly long story short, I studied all the things everyone else wanted me to study. I became the person that everyone else wanted me to become. Ended up at Warwick, and after Warwick, got a job as a management consultant in the city, where I worked for about 4 years. Used to work incredibly long hours, from 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. And just to escape the reality of the job and just the pressure, I used to write. So I used to write every morning on the tube on my way to work, and every weekend. All I ever did was write. And this happened for a period of 3 years. And what initially started off as a collection of thoughts ended up being my first book, Gypsy Masala. Now, one day, I just went into work. My job was to make businesses profitable and also to coach people to follow their dreams. And I thought I was being a complete hypocrite because I absolutely hated my job and I was telling everyone how to follow their dreams. So I just walked into work one day and I said to my boss, I'm resigning. And she said, to do what? And I said, to be a writer. And she just laughed. She said, you know, the percentage of people that actually make a living out of writing is so minimal that, you know, I want you to think carefully about it. But I left work that day, and I just had this huge buzz sending out my manuscripts. I put Gypsy Masala in manuscript form, sent it off in the jiffy bag to various publishing companies. And at this stage, did not tell anyone that I had stopped working. I just said to my friends and my family that I had gone freelance, hoping that I was going to soon get a huge publishing deal and it would all come together. It didn't happen that way. Every single jiffy bag came back, either unread, with the manuscript unread, or with the letter incorrectly written, so wrong book, wrong author, sent back to me, or people had read it and just not liked it. So every single manuscript came back rejected. And then I thought, what am I going to do? I've just given up my job. I've given up, you know, I don't know what else to do. So I decided, and it was simple as thinking, I am going to self-publish. I'm going to get my books into a position where they're so successful that a big publishing company is going to snap me up. And that was my thought process. So I did a lot of research into self-publishing. I looked at, you know, how you could do it. Went to lots of different conferences and basically found out how to self-publish. At that stage, I was in the process of buying a flat. So I took the deposit that I was going to put down into the flat and put it all into self-publishing. Did not tell my parents, did not tell my friends, just said I was going freelance. And I don't know what possessed me to do that, but that's what I did. And very early on, I knew that PR and marketing was going to play a huge part in the whole, you know, the whole book thing. So I didn't have enough money for a PR person, so what I did was, quite ashamed to say this, but I created this feisty woman by the name of Prue Menon, who was myself, and I had a PR company called The Creative House, which I made look like a huge multinational, which was in my back bedroom. So I had two phone lines, two fax lines, two email addresses, and I just began shamelessly hyping this book to all journalists that I could think of. I mean, I did probably about 70 to 80 calls every single day just hyping. That's all I did for a period of 4 months. And was very successful in that because I got a lot of radio interviews, a lot of press coverage. But there was a slight problem because when you self-publish, it's completely down to you to check proofs, to check everything is correct. So, as I said, you know, I didn't tell my friends or my family or my parents that I had done this, and I was going to the printers who was actually my printer, but it was my publishing company as well, where it was going down to Northampton to collect my book. I remember driving back down to London, feeling incredibly happy, and my parents had thrown this party downstairs for me because they thought I was reputably published by my publishing company, Ninefish. I walked into the house and this little voice inside my head said, go upstairs and look at page 179. So I went upstairs, looked at page 179, and it was completely and utterly blank. So the whole of my savings was ploughed into this book, which was about £10,000, had no job, and the press needed the book for that week, and there was a blank page. I could not sell the books, I couldn't do anything. So I called up the printer. I went back downstairs, was polite to guests, got rid of them all, came back upstairs, called up the printer, and I said, please tell me it's not my fault. And he said, it's not your fault, I missed a plate, but we've got a bit of a problem because to reprint and rebind these books, it's going to take 4 to 6 weeks. Now, I didn't have 4 to 6 weeks, I only had 3 days, because with press, if you promise them material, you have to get it for that day, otherwise they move on to the next story or whatever, so those books had to be there, whatever. So I thought, he's not going to get these books here, what shall I do? So I said, okay, print me 3,000 copies of page 179 and courier them down to me. So he printed these 179 pages, 3,000 copies, couriered them down to me, and I literally sat for 3 days and nights prick-sticking them in to this book. I prick-stick. And then I got all the copies out to press that I had promised, and then I was sitting on 2,500 books, which I could not obviously sell. So I was like thinking, what am I going to do with all these books? And where I used to work above my desk, there was a whole notice board with lots of different ideas. And I promise you, this leaflet came floating down, landed face up, and said London Book Fair. So I thought, aha, I'm supposed to be at the London Book Fair. So I called up the organisers of the London Book Fair, and she just laughed at me because I said, can I have a stall and can I have a present? And the London Book Fair was taking place late that week, so it was 4 days or something. She said, people call up 18 months beforehand to have a present. It takes a lot of organisation. You can't just suddenly call up and say, can I have... And I said, okay, so it's not possible. She said, no, but leave me your number just in case. You know, we never have cancellations, but leave me your number. And 20 minutes later, she called me up to say there had been a cancellation, and she gave me the stall at half price. Now, at this stage, I couldn't go as the publisher, the publicist, and the author, so I had to tell two of my very closest friends, what I was doing. They found it incredibly mad, but they agreed to come along with me. So we all three of us went to London Book Fair. Teresa, a good friend of mine, came as part of the Creative House, and another friend, Avni, came as part of Ninefish. So we were all there, and I went as the author. And whereas HarperCollins, Penguin, all the big major players were giving out leaflets, we were giving out books. So we created quite a stir at the London Book Fair, and everyone was going, who is Nine Fish? We've never heard of them, blah, blah, blah. And at the London Book Fair, I met two very important people that I didn't know would be incredibly useful years later, but I met these two people, and that's our story, and I'll come back to that. So, went to London Book Fair, was going to all my radio interviews, and was sitting at, on the Julia Somerville radio show, and she said, so, where can we get a hold of Gypsy Masala? And it sounds incredibly silly and incredibly naive, but I thought just because I had them at a major distributor's that they would automatically go to all the bookshops in London or all over the UK, but it doesn't work like that. In publishing, the bestsellers that you think you've made bestsellers are not bestsellers because you have chosen them. It's because the publishers have bought shelf space, they've bought window space, they've bought presents. So in it, they have reps that go 6 months in advance to all these bookshops in London and sell in the titles. Now, I did not have any reps. So basically, after my interviews, armed with a travel card, I went pounding the streets of London with these books, with Gypsy Masala, and I took them to about 200 bookshops in the space of a week. And I said, you don't know who I am, but I promise you in a year's time, you'll know who I am. Well, I just said that because I didn't know what else to say. And what happened was, a lot of the bookshop owners thought I was absolutely crazy, and they just sent me away. A few others actually read Gypsy Masala and made it staff choice. Now, staff choice has a huge influencing power. So next time I went to my local store, which is Finchley Road Books, etc., I walked in and Gypsy Masala was there at number 9. So I said, why is this book here at number 9? I thought it was quite a nice little small book, so I thought they'd just stuck it there. And she said, it's our fastest selling title. It's outselling The Booker, The Orange, and we've done 2,500 copies. Now, 2,500 copies is a third of my print run, and that's in one shop. And so she said, yeah, our store manager, our managing director is taking it on to all 36 branches. Now, 36 branches, multiply that by an average of 2,000, that's a hell of a lot of books. So I got onto my printer and said, okay, start printing more books, and it was all going fantastically well. 2.5 years I'd waited for that moment where, you know, major chain picked me up. And also in conjunction with that, a fantastic thing had happened. One journalist had found out that I was the publisher, the publicist, and they were going to run a huge story in a paper down in London called The Evening Standard, which is quite a big, has a fantastic readership. Anyway, at this stage I thought I'd better tell my mum and dad. Just don't want my dad to read up The Evening Standard and see a picture of me in there. And so I told my parents what I was doing, and just then my father thought it was absolutely crazy. Did not really comment much, but just said, okay, get on with whatever you have to do. So everything came together. Press came together, distribution came together, the sales were going fantastically well, and I got the printer to print more books. And then I was stopped dead in my tracks because 3 years ago in London, I think also the rest of the UK, there was the petrol crisis, the oil crisis, where you could not move anywhere. So the books that were ready to go out into all these shops and momentum which had been created by all the publicity, because after The Evening Standard it got picked up by not every single, but a lot of the national papers. Momentum which took 3 years to create had passed me by, because the date that happened, those 4 days coincided with that petrol strike of that week. So I was sitting on a load of books. I was heavily, heavily, heavily in debt, and couldn't do anything because these books couldn't be transported. And by the time that thing had finished, you know, the book chain did take the books, but there was nowhere near the momentum that there would have been had that strike not happened. So basically, that story, that whole story ended there. Nothing happened. And I was heavily in debt. I had to think whether I was going to go back into management consultancy or whether I was going to write another book. And I really, at that stage, did want to give up, because it was 3 years of work being everyone else but myself and everyone else but a writer. So what I decided to do was to take myself off and write. And I thought, at least I'll get this story out of my system and then I'll go back into work. That was my plan. Get the story out and then I'll return to work. So there were these two people that I met at the London Book Fair. One of them was a lady called Tricia Stewart, whose film now, Calendar Girls, has just been released. She was one of the WI members who that story is based on. And they were going to America to promote their calendar. So she said, we're going for 6 weeks, you can have my cottage for 6 weeks. So I said, okay, I'll take the cottage for 6 weeks. And she said, and you can also have my agent. Just call her up when you need her. If you need someone to read what you're writing, just call her up. You know, just any advice you want, just, you know, Diana will help you. So I'm thinking, okay. So I started writing, and 100 Shades of White literally poured out of it. It was just because I hadn't written for 3 years. It was just flowing. And I used to fax Diana the pages or email Diana the pages. And all she would say is, write more, write more. And at the end of 6 weeks, I had written this book because it was the first time I was writing for someone. So I wrote 100 Shades of White in 6 weeks. She read it. She said, I will have no problem selling this book or anything you subsequently write. So she took it round to the various publishers who had rejected me with Gypsy Masala, and it went to auction. So a book that they could have had 3 years earlier, a fraction of the cost them a little bit more. So 100 Shades of White went to auction, and I signed a three-book deal with HarperCollins, purely because they were going to republish and reprint Gypsy Masala at a later stage. And that's where I'm at with them at the moment. I've just finished my third book, which is out in September. Gypsy Masala will also be reprinted in September. 100 Shades of White is out in paperback, and the BBC have bought the rights to do a two-part drama next year. So, perseverance is all I have to say on that subject. And shall I ask questions now, or shall I move on to the reading?
It's up to you. Would you like to read a bit now?
Yeah, is that okay?
Would you like to read?
Okay, so I'll do a bit of a reading.
Perhaps before you read, you could let us know what the book's about and give it a background.
Let's
put it into context.
Okay, so 100 Shades is about... It's about a mother-daughter relationship, really, and it's about seeing the same event from two completely different perspectives. So the mother, Nalini, has the most fantastic, opulent life with her husband in India. And then he works for a huge oil company and travels around a lot. So he comes to London, and Nalini and Rahul, her husband, have two children, Sachin and Maya. And Rahul brings the whole family to London, and that's the point where I'm going to start reading from. Okay, so this is the bit where Nalini just has come to England with her two children. Rahul has brought them to England. Okay. England was damp, despite it being the middle of the summer, and there were hardly any people on the streets. I didn't understand a word the driver Rahul had sent to collect us was saying to me, and felt frightened. I held my children tightly as we went to meet my husband. Rahul looked like a stranger when I saw him again. Arrogance had filled his head and tilted his jaw, so he no longer looked at you but above you. He took us to a large, impressive house, complete with wall-to-wall chandeliers and thick carpet. It was a cold house, with no space around it, filled in a row with others like it, but my children were happy. They were with their father and about to begin a new adventure. Children adapt. It's us adults who find change hard. I longed to go home to be with my mother, and when the children went to school and when my husband was away or at work, this solitude ate into me and made me ache, a nagging pain in my chest that would not go away. I tried to go out, but hated the constant reminders that I was in a foreign place. Being in the house was difficult as it was without being introduced to further strangeness. The constant drone of traffic also annoyed me. It was so monotonous compared to the chaos of street life back home. There was not the jumbled up sound of people trying to make their way across the road, attempting to dodge the rickshaws and the cows, no pungent smells coming from street corners, nor the busy noise of bartering. No street sellers vainly shielding their wares from being polluted by the big, heavy buses passing through town. No vibrant dancing colours. There were washing lines. Imagine washing hanging in an orderly manner on lines with no dhobi scurrying about finding patches of grass to put the clothes on. Even the rain fell without conviction. It was so organised, from the traffic, the food in the stores to the houses. Gas, electricity, water. All of it flowed in an organized manner whenever you needed it. People even contained their emotions. They didn't talk to each other but looked warily. Neighbours' curtains would twitch, but windows and doors were kept firmly shut. No sellers came to the door offering bangles, fresh fish, material or vegetables, and gossip. Maybe the catalogue man came and left the catalogue at the door or rang the bell and left. One day, the postman had delivered a neighbour's letter to our house by mistake, so I knocked on the door to give it to her. A middle-aged woman came to answer it. She kept her foot firmly shut against the door and peered through the gap. She did not invite me in or offer tea or savouries, but said a polite thank you and closed the door again. England was a lonely, lonely place. Raoul went to work early and came home late. Occasionally he spent time with the children. Sometimes he went out with his friends, but seldom was I invited. Even if I was, I did not fit into the social circle, and the blunders I made were all too evident. "Melanie, don't do it like that. Use a napkin," Raoul would complain, or he would laugh at me in front of everyone at my lack of knowledge. I sat around tables, feeling ignorant as people conversed in a foreign language, and all I could do was smile, although I couldn't even do this right because inside I didn't feel happy. Happiness was a state of mind. Happiness was a state of mind. If I said it enough times, perhaps it would seep into my consciousness. I had to do something, anything, so I got Raoul to have groceries and spices delivered to the house. At least I could cook to keep my sanity. I cooked huge meals and placed them on the dining room table. From morning to night I would concoct dishes, remembering spices and stories from my mother, cook and forget the place I was in. I would polish the cutlery and decorate the table. Nobody ate what I made. Raoul had either eaten at the office or with clients or friends, and the children preferred their newfound meals of burgers and fish fingers. I would secretly garnish these with spices so they would never forget the place that they were from. Every day I got instructions from them to make new foods. "Ma, can you make us omelette and toast?" "What's omelette and toast, ma clé?" "Like mutadosha with no chilies and hot bread," Sachin replied. I beat the eggs with coriander leaves, added half a chili, crushed peppercorns and onions, and toasted the bread on the chinchati with ghee. They complained about the green bits. It felt like I was losing the battle. The children were consumed by the adventure, and the only thing that consoled me was the thought that it was temporary and that we would be going home soon. Tom, the young man who delivered spices, came religiously every week, and I filled containers of food for him to take back. It would have been wasted otherwise. This made me look forward to his visits, even though he had fingernails like the tree climber. Every time he came, he taught me a new English word or sentence. "This, Mrs. K, is called a pumpkin, and this is a marrow." Containers were exchanged in this way, and a year later I could understand him and give him whole sentences back as well. He would always encourage me, and as he left, he would say, "You're a fast learner, Mrs. K, it's coming on really well." Raoul had gone on a trip that autumn to America, and normally when he went away, he would call every week. 2 weeks went by, and there had been no news. He telephoned the following Wednesday, and instead of asking how we were or telling us when he would be back, he gave me strict instructions to give Tom one of his suits to dry clean. It seemed such an odd request. So I asked him, was it because he would be returning within the next day or so? "Yes," he said, "soon." I waited for him to ask about Sachin and Maya, but he didn't, so I ended the conversation by saying that the children were fine and that we all missed him. He made no response other than to say that he was really very busy and had to go. Later that afternoon, when I was cleaning, I remembered the suit. I went into the walk-in closet and began looking for it, the pinstripe blue one. Finding it amongst the hundreds he had, I took the suit out and placed it on the bed. I went to fetch a bag to put it in, and as I folded it, I thought I'd better check the pockets to make sure that there were no tissues or loose change. From the breast pocket of the blue suit, I pulled out a picture. It was of Raoul with his arms around a blonde woman, and placed between them a young child. Confused, I stared at the photograph. On the back were some words that I could not read. I felt numb. Thoughts went round my head in circles. Who was this woman? Who was the child? Was there some mistake? I rooted through his closet and found pictures and letters in a shoebox. None of it made sense. Who was she? I needed Raoul home. I needed to speak to him. He would sort it out and tell me that there was some big mistake. It was 4 o'clock and the children would be home soon. I put the things back in their place, and when they arrived, I made them something to eat, sat and played with them, and tried to go to sleep. Days passed, waiting for a phone call, a letter, anything. A week went by, and my anguish mounted as the children asked for their father. I made up stories that he would be back within the week, and then another week went by, no news. And then I got a call from the office, but I didn't want to understand, and asked them to call back on Thursday lunchtime. Tom came then. They rang, and I watched him as his face turned white and he hung up. Mrs. Kay, there's no easy way to say this, but he's gone. They can't find him. Embezzled money from the company and left. I shook my head, not comprehending. He's disappeared. They want to know when you'll be leaving the house. They've someone coming next week. No, I shook my head. Tom came to touch me. Go, I screamed. Go. Mrs. Kay, can I do something? Can I call someone? What shall I do? No, 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 I cried in disbelief. Go away. I can't leave you like this, not like this. Go, I screamed again. He left, saying that he would call on the way back home. As the door closed behind him, my hands began to tremble. Tears streamed down my face, and then I screamed and screamed until there was no breath left in me. Ma, where are you? Help me. I lay on the ground like some animal, pulling at my hair, choking on the tears. I looked up and saw his pictures on his table. I crawled onto my knees and threw them to the floor, smashing them with my fists and cutting my hand on the pieces. Why? Why did he bring us to this place only to leave us? Why? Didn't he know that what it would do? If he were planning to leave, why didn't he prepare us? Did he? Had I missed the signs? Did he mean to leave us money and air tickets to get back home? Maybe he did. I got myself off the floor and searched the house, desperately overturning every piece of furniture. I went into every room. Nothing. He left us nothing. Ma, help me. Talk to me. What shall I do? I screamed. Tell me. There was silence. My children. What would I tell the children? In 2 hours they would be home. I made my way to the kitchen and began to cook frantically. The blood from my hand covered the marrow as I picked it up and began to chop. Blood and tears dripped into the pan and made the oil splatter. Blood seeped into the wooden spoon as I held the spoon tighter and tighter. I began to stir. Who was this man who called himself a husband and a father? What kind of person could be that cruel? Why? Security, stability, certainty, kindness. He pretended to have all those things, to give all those things, but he took them away so ruthlessly. I didn't even know where he was, even who he was, or if he was ever coming back. As the spoon went round and round in circles, I made myself a promise. I swore that this would be the last time he would ever disrupt our lives. No matter what reasons he had, he could never come back. And I would do whatever it took to keep my children away from him. Nobody could come back with this, with the pitiful excuse of being a father. He didn't deserve them, and so that was the day he died. Having everything taken away, brick by brick, puts you in a position where you don't care what else leaves you. There is nothing more to lose. My only concern was for my children. To protect them, to provide for them, and to make sure they evolved into good people. I went to collect them and to tell them that their father had lost his life by jumping in the middle of the road to save a little boy who was about to be killed by a bus. Maya did not cry or scream. She looked at me. Tears rolled down Sachin's face as his sister watched. He's not coming back, I whispered, unable to get the words out. But there was incomprehension. Do you understand, Maya? I said as I held her. She nodded. Sachin began to cry. My heart felt heavy at the enormity of what I was doing to them, but it was the right thing to do. I knew it was. I kissed them both, promising that it would be all right, that I would always be there for them, no matter what. When we got home, we said a prayer together and lit a candle so that they were able to say goodbye to him. My children slept close to me as I lay there thinking what would happen to us. Was it better to scrape together the fare and go back to India? Where could we go? How would we manage there? 2 children, a woman on her own, it wasn't possible. I didn't know where my mother was. Maybe she was still in the village, but I couldn't take them back there. That would be the first place he would look for us, if he ever decided to return. The doorbell interrupted my thoughts. It was Tom. He tried to smile, but all he could say was that he was sorry and offered to help us in any way he could. He sat down with me and I asked him to read out the letters that were in the shoebox. I needed to know. Tom shook his head. Do you really want to do this to yourself, Mrs. K? Yes, I need to know all of it, I replied. Every one of them was from a lady called Marissa, who asked when he would return and if the minor problems he was having that required him to stay in England had been solved. They were all signed, "Come back soon because we love you and we miss you." "I'm sorry, Mrs. K. I'll try and help you in any way that I can. You just say," Tom said as he folded the letters away. "Do you have a match?" I asked as I took back the box. He looked at me and then rooted through his pockets and found a matchbox. I lit the match and set fire to the letters, watching them burn into ashes. "He's dead now, buried. We need somewhere to live." I asked him if he could find people to buy our furniture and anything else of value and help us find somewhere to go. He said he would take it all to a second-hand dealer he knew on the Bow Road and asked his sister if we could stay with her. By the following Friday, the house was almost empty, and all that was left in the dining room were the suitcases we came with, cardboard boxes packed with necessities, and a few of the children's toys. Tom came at exactly 5 o'clock as promised and loaded up the van with our possessions. The children sat between us in the front of the van and Tom was talking to them about his sister, her cats, whilst I sat thinking, worrying. Suddenly Maya shouted, "Jemina, where's my Jemina?" Jemina was the doll she carried with her, the doll he'd bought her. "She's probably in the back, Maya, with the boxes," I said. "No, no, I need to see her. I need to see her now," Maya insisted. "No problem, Melanie. I can stop here so we can check Jemina's all right," said Tom, pulling over. Maya went with him to check the boxes in the back of the van, and then she began crying. "She's not here. She's gone. Jemina's gone, gone. She won't come back. Will she, Mummy?" "Maya, don't cry, sweetheart. I'll go back to the house when the new owners come, when it's daytime, and check for you. She might be there," Tom reassured her. "No," she wailed even louder. "I know she's not coming back. She's gone." I got out of the van to get her. My little girl was lying on the roadside. Tom was unable to console her. I picked her up. "Mummy's here, Maya. Mummy's here." "No," she sobbed, burying her head in my hair, her face soaked with tears. "Achen, I want my Achen."
Thank you. That was really fascinating.
Thank you.
Before we open up to questions, it's my privilege to be able to ask the first one. I was just wondering to what extent events in the novel stem from your own experiences. Would you say it's an autobiographical novel at all?
It's not exactly an autobiographical novel, because I don't think I would have said it was an autobiography. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a work of fiction does justice if you just completely poach from your own life. But it's got a lot of my life in it and a lot of what happened to me that fictionalised, so mm-hmm. all the emotions, all the sentiments are mine, but they're all fictionalised.
Mm-hmm. So do you identify with any of the characters?
All of them.
So they've all got bits of you within them?
Bits of me or bits of people I know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Another one of the main themes of the book is the way that you explore mother-daughter relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, what are your thoughts behind that? What were you trying to say in the book?
I think the mother-daughter relationship is absolutely the most complex relationship, specifically in my life. I don't know if it's in other people's lives, but I think your parents do the very best to protect you, and you sometimes misinterpret that, and as is the case in the book, you know, the mother has told a lie, a blatant lie, but she does that to protect her child's sense of self-worth and in the sense of being. And Maya has built her whole life upon that one lie. The fact that her father died heroically, the fact that, you know, it happens in so many cases. There are so many skeletons and so many closets in our own families and things that we don't know. And when we find them out, we think it's for some kind of devious reasons that we weren't told that. But very often the root is that we're not told certain things to protect us.
Mm-hmm. So that very much lies within the kind of the title
of the book, 100 Shades of White,
yeah.
Would you say?
100 Shades of White for me is that truth is not absolute, it doesn't come in black or white.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in many different shades, hence the title.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions that you'd like to ask? Don't be shy. Ricky?
I had the very beginning of the story. I didn't know where it was going. I just knew the very beginning. And I just literally wrote it. I would go out for long walks, come back, and just write bits of it. And then it kind of evolved by itself.
Over dinner, you told us a really fascinating thing about walking.
Mm. I actually wrote this book because I read this fantastic book called The Artist's Way by a lady called Julia Cameron. And she kind of prescribes walking for a fantastic way of overcoming writer's block, or you know, if you're blocked creatively. And it's when you walk, it gives the opportunity of both sides of the brain to balance out. So when you're creatively blocked, I think it's because you're predominantly using your right side, and your right side doesn't have a chance to speak to your left side. So when the actual physical act of walking gives both an opportunity to converse with each other. So she says, begin with the end in mind. So when you go out walking, think that you've written the whole book, and you fool your subconscious, because the act of moving with your feet, it actually fools your subconscious into thinking, oh, I've done it. So when you get back into your desk and you start writing, it should pour out, and that's how it happened with me. I followed this book word for word, and that's how I wrote it in 6 weeks.
Yes.
Influences are from mostly from experience and from life things, all stories that have been passed down to me by my mother and my grandparents, and then yes, reading as well, but mostly through experience.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you
spoke
about
thank you.
But you said that you can identify by yourself, really careful.
I think what I do through writing is make sense of what I already know. So certain facts I already know. I know this happened, I know that happened. But then I make sense of it through the writing. So it's not necessarily... I think I know quite a lot about myself, so I'd like to think I do anyway. But in actually writing it down, it kind of, you just break it down, and I learn a lot about events from writing.
Any more questions?
It kind of sets the book in some context, because there's other bits. There are very, very funny bits, there are very, very sad bits, but they've got no context to them, so I thought that would just set the plot a little bit and give an indication of what the story is about. That's where that particular bit.
Can you perhaps tell us a little about how the story develops?
I know you don't want to give too much away. And you know what? It's because I've just finished my third book. I'm actually thinking, okay, so how does this story work? What happens is that the whole family moves to a bedsit in the East End of London. And Tom's sister, Maggie, they have the most appalling life, Tom and his sister Maggie, but this young family moves next door, and that's where their life really starts to take off in the most poorest, direst of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother gets on her feet and starts making homemade pickle. Another huge theme through this book is cooking. Cooking is hugely interwoven throughout the book, and the plot is driven mainly by food and the pickles that she makes and the recipes. And the reason why I've done this is I'm from Kerala, and Ayurvedic influence is a huge influence in my life, that, you know, certain foods have got healing properties such as turmeric and heal wounds both internally and externally, so I've put all the recipes together and driven the plot through it. And also food in Kerala, as well as the whole of India, I feel, is symbolic of love. You know, as soon as you go into someone's house, you're immediately offered 101 different dishes, and not to accept the food is kind of, it's not just impolite, but it almost hurts. And so Maya not accepting, you know, her mother's cooking is just an absolute rejection of the mother in itself. So that's why.
Yeah, that's quite a key part in the book, isn't it? When she's young and she doesn't want to eat her mother's food.
Mm.
I mean, with the one of the things you're exploring in the novel is kind of the magical healing power of food. Would you kind of describe it as a magical realist novel at all?
I'd like to think so, because my influences, the people that I read, are magical realists. So I would like
who are they?
Isabel Allende, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, all those people that see, you know, ordinary life and then the most magical, amazing things happen in absolutely everyday ordinary life, as is in my ordinary life as well.
So did you research the novel much when it came to the different healing properties in food? Or
no, because
did you just know it all?
No, because my mother, like Melanie, is a cook, so mm-hmm. I was brought up with a cook who knows it all.
Oh,
so,
lucky
yeah.
you.
Absolutely.
Do you have any more questions?
It's really difficult because knowing all that I know now, like I know the publishing industry inside out, I think I'm best placed, I know it better than most people would know it, only because I've seen it from both sides. I've seen it from the author side, being a publisher myself, dealing with all these people, dealing with bookshops. So I don't know how the hell I got through the system as a self-published and how I made that company successful, because there are so many things going on. It's all to do with contacts, who you know, interests, advances, all these different politics going on. And so armed with all that information, would I do what I did 3 years ago? Absolutely no way. But you know, ignorance is such a fantastic thing, and that belief that you have, and that belief, and that the complete naivety that, you know, if I really want to make this work, I can make it work. And that's all that fueled me, that's all I had. I didn't have a penny to my name, but I had belief. And the thing is, I don't have that belief. I mean, I have belief in other things now, but knowing everything that I know, I would not have that belief. Does that make sense to you? Yeah.
But a big theme in Gypsy Masala is the kind of the power of dreams.
Mm. Which was the biggest irony, because Gypsy Masala was all about following your dreams. It's the story of three people that, you know, and the narrator asks them, have you dared to follow your dreams? And in following their dreams, they follow their worst nightmares, and they tell you a story about their fears and a story about their past and why they haven't gone to follow their dreams. But I didn't even know how much this was going to impact my life, because I wrote the book about, it was a story about dreams, and I literally had to follow my own dream, and I literally had to follow my own fears and my own nightmares, which is, you know, the fear of being rejected, the fear of, you know, people criticizing. I hate those, I shrivel at those things, even today. I'd rather, if you know, if you've read the book and you don't like it, you don't tell me, you know, simple as that. I mean, I still don't like it, but back in those days, I had to put myself in a position where I was rejected by journalists, rejected by bookshop owners, rejected by every single day was rejection. So I think in following your dreams, you follow your worst scenario or one, you know, your fears, but that just makes you stronger.
How did you cope with that rejection? It must have been very demoralising.
It was, but it was easy because I kind of disassociated myself from the book and disassociated myself by using the other persona and said, right, okay, it's happened, carry on, because no one else is going to promote it, no one else is going to do it for me. I had to carry on, so it was all kind of condensed in there, and that's why I think I had a lot of angst after the 3 years. So that's why I think also I wrote it in 6 weeks, because there was a lot bubbling away.
Have you ever been tempted to publish more with Nine Fish and take that, your publishing house, further?
No, but I have very funny stories, because I have, Nine Fish doesn't exist anymore as a company, because it's still there, but it doesn't really, I don't do anything with it. But I got this letter from this, it was actually Catherine someone, and as an editor, and I signed it saying, you know, we're not talking, taking on any new authors at the moment, but thank you for your manuscript. I just had some nightmare scenarios going in, just absolute. I was shortlisted as publicist of the year, well, Prue was shortlisted as publicist of the year, because I managed to gain so much coverage for Gypsy Masala. And I couldn't go to the award ceremony because, for example, my publicist now is Helen Johnston. And Helen Johnston, she did My Life on a Plate by Indian Knight, so it would be My Life on a Plate by Indian Knight, publicised by Helen Johnston, and then mine underneath it was Gypsy Masala by Nine Fish, promoted by Prue Menon, and also all the publishers and all the publicists, and they were all sitting at one table, so I could not literally go and sit on one table on my own or get my friends to do it, because I thought that would be, and I was praying that I wouldn't win this thing. And the lady that eventually ended up winning was Helen, who's now my publicist. So
isn't that funny?
Just lots of different, different crazy scenarios.
Do you kind of believe in fate?
Absolutely. Because I've just had so many. The people that I met, kind of. I also remember that I was desperate to find funding for this Gypsum Sun. I didn't want to plough my money in. I mean, you know, it was £10,000. It was a lot of money. It was all I had at the time, and I wanted to get someone else to do it. So, I used to literally gate crash parties where I used to know people would be at, and I used to just put on the dress, go in, and just mingle. And I remember going to this rich. It was called the Richless Party down in London, and I just gate crashed it. And one of one of the guys that I was speaking to, I'd actually approached him for funding. He'd forgotten about it because he probably gets thousands of requests every day. And I was shortlisted, I had to go for this interview for Asian Woman of Achievement or something. And he was there as one of the judges, and he was next to the head of the Princess Trust, and I had to speak to him. And all throughout this interview he was saying, you know, we've met, you and I have met, I know we've met, I can't place it. And I said to him, I'll tell you where we've met afterwards, or, you know, at the end of it. And so he said, so where did we meet? And I said, oh, we met in 99 at the Richless Party. And he said, and your father is? And I told him what my father does. My dad said, buys and sells steel. And so he says, is that Lakshmi Mittal, who's one of the biggest steel barons in India? And I said, no, it's my dad's name. He said, oh, I'm sorry. And I said, no, I didn't come because of my dad. And he said, how can I ask how you got invited? And I said, yeah, it was simple. Put on a black dress and walk right through. And he was horrified. But actually ended up winning that year. So a lot of people, and you know, people that I'm, the team at HarperCollins, I'd met them way before because of the various, you know, selling into bookshops, doing all of it, so it all works out in the end.
How did you feel when you won the Young Achiever Award at the Asian?
I thought it was quite funny, actually, because of everything that had happened. You know, people only get to see the best bits, but if you really knew how it was all cobbled together behind the scenes, and if it was a homespun cottage industry, you would just laugh. It's just incredibly funny. Mm-hmm. The whole story is very funny. So. Mm.
Does anyone else have any more questions they'd like to ask?
Yeah, it was quite difficult because the last people that I wanted to read it was actually my mum and dad. So it actually came out, and we get proof copies, authors get proof copies like 6 months before, and I didn't want to give it to them, so I waited till the book where the hardback was published, and I gave it to my dad. It was my dad that was most kind of afraid of, because there's a lot of my dad, or not my dad, in it. And I met him the next day and he said, I just cried. I read it and I cried. And it was so sweet because my dad never cried. And it was just so lovely, that the subsequent support, you know, that I've had from them. And I was quite scared, actually, for them to read it, but it worked out well.
Do you ever get friends asking you to put them in your novel?
No. My friends always try to identify themselves. I'm like, no.
You could get revenge on various people.
Absolutely.
Any more questions? And would you describe the novel as a love story? Because there are lots of kind of intimate relationships in the novel.
Love stories on different levels, I think. Not just man-woman, but like mother-daughter.
Yeah.
Stepfather, child.
Yeah. You do explore all those different
relationships. It's mostly about relationships and exploring them. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So who's your favourite character in the novel? My last question. Do you have one?
I would say it's the grandmother, the grandmother's voice. She doesn't actually appear in the book, it's her sayings and her voice, which is just directly taken from my own grandmother.
Why does she disappear? Because she's quite present at the start of the book, and then her voice comes back at the end.
Because the whole novel is about letting go. Mm-hmm. It's all about letting go, just of what's come before, the past, letting go. And the grandmother had to let go of her daughter, although she knew everything that was going to happen to her daughter. You know, that you know, they would come to England, that Raoul was a bad man, whatever. She still let her daughter go, and she let her daughter make her own mistakes. And that's what's so hard to do in a parent-child relationship. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a really beautiful novel. I really enjoyed reading it myself. The bookshop are outside, and they're selling copies of both 100 Shades of White
and Gypsy Masala to 10% discount. And you've kindly agreed to stay in here to sign copies at the end. So do go and get a book and then come back in here to get it signed if you'd like to have a first edition signed. But if you could perhaps all join with me now in thanking Preeti for such a wonderful reading and insightful evening.
Thank you.